What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Each week, Politalk dives straight into the tough questions. Like what happens if a World War II shipwreck ruptures and unleashes thousands of liters of oil into our ocean?
Across the Pacific, there's around 3,800 of these World War II shipwrecks which are potentially polluting.
To listen, search Politalk in your favourite podcast app.
This is an ABC podcast.
Talofa lava ali en bulavinaka. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. My name is Kristen Rita Aumanu-Leong, your Friday host, coming to you live from Solomon Islands capital, Honiara. Coming up on the show, Tonga's government launches a new policy to help deportees reintegrate. Here in Solomon Islands, there are calls for the government to save a youth hub. We'll be speaking to the co-founder of Dreamcast Theatre. And later on in the show, we'll travel back in time to find out what was the driving force behind Polynesian migration across the Pacific. All that and more coming up. Wherever you're listening in from, I say tagyo tumas, and thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, yours in the Pacific. First, we begin in Timor-Leste, where Timor police have made further arrests this week following multiple raids on alleged scam centres. About 350 people have now been detained in a major crackdown on suspected international scam operations. As Zivonia Vieira reports, investigators are examining links to fraud, money laundering and possible human trafficking.
Inside large residential homes and highly secure compounds, police detain hundreds of alleged scammers, seizing laptops, phones, Starlink units, and thousands of SIM cards. Secretary Staff of Communication Expedito Diasimene says the raids send a warning to organized crime.
The government reaffirms that Timor-Leste will not tolerate the use of national territory for transnational criminal activities, including electronic fraud, online fraud, money laundering, human trafficking, or other forms of organized crime that violate the law and threaten national sovereignty and interests.
Timor-Leste police raided multiple heavily secure call center compounds over the past week in a major crackdown against what Express says is a growing threat in the developing nation. The United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime Regional Representative Delphine Sanch says criminal groups are moving into countries like Timor as authorities put pressure on scam compounds in Southeast Asia.
It's a country that has a growing connectivity. There are some limited regulatory and law enforcement resources. There's also the fact that Timor is a very dollarized economy and has some limited financial intelligence capacity.
The UN estimates hundreds of scam centers operating across countries including Cambodia, Myanmar, and Laos generate more than $50 billion a year.
Timor-Leste is a very, very new country. It's more seen like as a business opportunity for big foreign criminal groups.
Many of the suspects arrested this week are Chinese and Indonesian nationals who are accused of money laundering, criminal association, and illegal online gaming. Police say the majority of workers charged entered on tourist visas, and the ABC understands more than 50 of the workers had no passports on them. Executive Director of Immigration Jorge Montero says investigators are examining how the workers came to Timor-Leste.
How to determine are most of them is a principal organizer, financial, or some of them is a victim of human trafficking, victim of people smuggling. That is after the investigation.
Ms. Sen says the confiscation of passport is a tactic frequently used by organized crime groups operating scams compounds in Southeast Asia.
This is indeed a sign that some of those people have actually been brought into these scam operations against their will and they're kind of like forced to commit those crimes.
Concern about scam operation in Timor-Leste first began last year after police raided a hotel in the Kusi region and uncovered what authorities allegate was an illegal online gambling and call center operation. University of Adelaide adjunct Professor Michael Rose visited the scam center involved after it was raided and said workers there were targeting a number of different countries.
There were calls going out to Brazil from Timorese who speak a bit of Portuguese. They found young people who speak Portuguese and got them to sort of make these phone calls. There were scam calls going out to Malaysia and Indonesia, once again, employing Bahasa-speaking Timorese as well as Indonesians. And there were scam calls going out in English.
Dr. Ross says this new race reveal the extensive spread of the alleged scam operation since last year, but also so Timor-Leste is up for the fight.
What the criminal networks are finding is that the place is no pushover. I suspect that it may come as sort of a surprise to some of these networks.
But the threat isn't confined to Timor-Leste. The United Nations says there are indications that similar criminal operations may be emerging in Papua New Guinea and elsewhere in the Pacific as the organized crime network searches for new territory. And Delphine Sen says countries will have to work together to stop it expanding.
So it really calls for very strengthened frameworks and international cooperation at various level, operational, police to police.
That was the United Nations Office of Drugs and Crimes, Delphine Shantz, ending that report from Zevonia Vieira. Good follow morning and welcome back to Pacific Beat. In Tonga, where a group set up to help deportees to the kingdom, says the adoption of a national returnees policy is a breakthrough in the effort to help people reintegrate into Tongan life. It's estimated that more than 1,000 Tongans have been deported from the United States, Australia and New Zealand since the 1990s, many with criminal convictions and many with no links to the communities that they're re-entering. Five of them set up Dare to Dream in 2019 to help these returnees adapt to life in Tonga, find jobs and overcome cultural and language barriers. The group's secretary, Katrina Mau-Fatiaki, says the government's national returnees policy that was launched this week should make that job easier.
The purpose of the policy is to really provide that oversight and governance reintegration process. So there's a number of different things. It also highlights, you know, the lived experience and the realities of the social stigma that they go through. It also looks at, you know, how to better improve opportunities and look at support mechanisms that should be provided to returnees. There's also discussions around, you know, looking at a facility that will help with the physical well-being of returnees. So it does look at a number of different things. And of course, there's also the spiritual and community aspect to it with a faith-based approach. And so some of our service providers are quite instrumental in that area. And there's also the guide. The policy is also a guide to mapping out, you know, how the community stakeholders and partners and government agencies can better work together in supporting our returnees. But the challenge now for us is that we've got a great policy. Now it's actually, you know, putting words into action.
That was leading into my next question, which was the resources for all of this. I saw from the local reports that Tonga's Crown Prince was the keynote speaker, and he raised the issue of resources and the limited resources there are to help returnees. Will there be enough resources to put some or all of this into action, do you think?
Well, you know, I can speak for us for Dare to Dream. We started with nothing, but we've worked strategically to work with key partners on the ground that has included the Australian government, the New Zealand government, and other partners to be able to, you know, get resources to do what we're doing. But you've got to start somewhere, and obviously resources are always needed. But, you know, when there's willpower, I feel that's a great driving component or motivation to mobilizing the resources. But what the policy has done is that, as I had mentioned, within the policy, there's also the strategic plan of action. And so it actually does highlight what are the resources that's needed. And so it's also a good booklet where the our partners as well as donors can pick up and actually see for themselves, okay, so this is the resources that they have identified. And so we're also grateful because the Australian and New Zealand government have been, you know, the greatest supporters of resourcing us and supporting us. So, you know, this is, I believe that this is better opportunities now for us to see some of the work that we've been also intending to do over the years, but with no resources. But now there's, you know, buy-in from government. You know, now it's strategically working closely with our government to, to be able to mobilize resources to do what we're mandated to do or called to do.
It's an issue that's gained prominence in recent years, you know, coinciding with the formation of Dare to Dream itself. Has much changed for returnees in that time since Dare to Dream was formed in 2019?
I think for us as board members, we could say yes, because we have done a lot of work over the years in terms of outreach and also awareness. You know, the issue always has been resourcing in terms of, you know, having an actual space. And that's been a process too. So right now we're currently building a rehabilitation reintegration hub. And we're just now waiting on the Ministry of Lands to sign off on paperwork so that we can get the land deed to be able to now work the land that that has been given to us. And that's also been a process. So we're quite supportive of, and I mean, quite happy and grateful for the support also with previous government and current government. So like the issue for Dare to Dream is just having that space so that we're able to really set up as an NGO and be able to bring our returnees to be so that they run our hub and be able to deliver on all the key things that they've been wanting to do. Because we've just been kind of working from different spaces and also working on limited resources. But we do see some impact in terms of those that we have have engaged. There's a few success stories through, you know, with our members. Like, for instance, we have one member, her name is Charlene Wolfgram. She runs one of the successful burrito food outlets that's in Tonga, and we've supported her through trainings. She's actually a qualified welder, but it was always a challenge for her to get employment in Tonga because it's always the, you know, they look at the profile and and often there's stigma to that. So there's and there's others, you know, change doesn't happen overnight. But we believe that the progress so far for Dare to Dream has been very progressive. And we have been one of the NGOs that have been quite instrumental in pushing for this policy. And there's great partnership with government. So this is the time. And I think riding on these opportunities and working closely now with other key government ministries and also other returnee service providers, you know, I think there's greater numbers now in terms of moving towards a stronger vision to really helping to rebuild the lives of returnees.
Katrina Maufatiaki from Dare to Dream speaking to Liam Fox.
Want the latest Pacific Rugby League and Union news and interviews with stars of the game? Tune in to Nation Footy with Sam Wykes and Tini Rau Arona.
I think the big thing that's changed, Sammy, is the way you go about it now. 20, 30 years ago, you could be quite direct with a player. And now it's more about trying to guide them to the solution themselves rather than being so blunt.
Nation Footy, Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Chris and Rita Aumanuliong here in Solomon Islands. Well, for nearly two decades, Dreamcast Theatre has been helping young Solomon Islanders find their voice through music, theatre, filmmaking and the arts. What started as a small community Theatre Group has grown into one of the country's leading youth organisations, providing a creative outlet for hundreds of young people and giving many a sense of purpose, belonging and hope. But the future of the hub is now uncertain. Transparency Solomon Islands is urging the government to step in amid reports that the building Dreamcast has called home since 2018 could soon be sold off. Supporters say there are a few dedicated creative spaces for young people here in Honiara, and losing the venue would be a major blow. Well, Neil Nuiya is a co-founder and creative director of Dreamcast Theatre, and he joins me on the line this morning. Neil, good fellow morning.
Morning, Chris and Rita. Good morning, good morning.
It's lovely to have you back on Pacific Beat. Look, what was your initial reaction when you found out about this?
It wasn't a surprise because I think we knew about the land way back, I think 3 years ago. But the urgency is, you know, most recently we found out that we could not, in a way, secure as we have thought, because we've, you know, managed to raise a couple of funds over the past years. So putting it together to go towards this purpose. But then as at last month, we basically ran out.
I mean, I understand it would have a lot of impact, especially on the many young people that you're working with. Now, if the sale actually goes ahead, what sort of impact will this have on a lot of young Solomon Islanders?
The sale has already taken effect, so we've signed this earlier this year. It's just a payment that we could not make. It's monthly installments, so Dreamcast is depending on monthly installments to go towards our Woodford, which is the seller of this property. Yeah, but what may happen is Dreamcast would move out. So we basically would continue our work, but it could be in more on a different location. We already thought about what it could look like. So maybe on a bus, in a big bus with a tent, drive, stop somewhere, and then set up Dreamcast. It's more Dreamcast Nomad.
But, I mean, it can be anywhere.
Exactly. But Dreamcast exists across the provinces as well. So we have about 300 young people part of the network. And there's like 60 daily users, 60 to roughly 80 daily users that uses the art center here. So that may affect our ongoing programs, the studio, the dance classes, but also the theater productions that we host. We will lose our stage, basically, our theater stage, which was built for us way back in the 80s. So, yeah.
There's been a lot that's been happening there, you know, two decades. So for people unfamiliar with Dreamcast, Neil, I mean, what sort of work do you do there? And why is art just so important in a place like Honiara?
So Dreamcast is a youth youth-led art organization. We've established in 2005 at Tuaruru. We've done most of our drama rehearsals under our mango tree, Kennedy Follis's mango trees. And then over the years, we've transitioned into what Dreamcast now. So, you know, building ourselves rebuilding legitimacy and trust during the process over the years from 2005 to 2018 when we first got the space here at Dreamcast. So when we opened the gate, it was basically a building that was old but has a stage. So we turned it into a magical space, opened it up to filmmaking, you know, other forms of art. Because what you know about in Solomon Islands, definition of art is what you see at the art gallery. Not most, not a lot on performing arts and, you know, expressive arts. So, you know, we've basically opened it up to other artists. Yeah, and then it became the collective that we are today. So I think the thing that got us together was filming our first feature film together with theater filmmakers, photographers, and all trying to build a film on the first year of getting the hub. And to be honest, in the process of filming, everyone was so confused what the role of director was, what, you know, learning on the process. But when we launched the film, it's called Juvenile. It's a film about juvenile and youth perspective of juvenile system in Solomons. When we launched the film and have it premiered here at Dreamcast, people loved it. People were emotional, even Speaker of Parliament, you know, said some really good words. And that sort of, Bami said, the birth of the collective, you know, everyone, you know, seeing what it could be, what it could look like, and how it could potentially work. So that's when the collective actually got closer together, and then we keep getting more and more young people joining us as an art collective. And so a lot of our work is around culture, cultural preservation through dance, language, songs. Also, advocacy is embedded into all that we do here at Dreamcast. So sharing young people's voices on issues that affect their lives, expressing that through art, but also working with communities to express their priorities to this through artistic approaches like films, theater, dramas, photography, and then having exhibitions and shows that get, you know, their leaders, decision-making bodies to be present and see opinions from these communities, but also with young people basically here in Honiara. So a lot of different things that we've done over the years. Yeah, but our work is mainly towards achieving social justice, social cohesion, but, you know, building confidence in the process, getting young people to see themselves in the process. During the scripting process, they learn about certain topics and having ownership of these topics in the process and delivering it on stage, or regardless of wherever it's delivered, it's always beautiful.
Absolutely. And as you mentioned there, the how people here perceive art is through art gallery, but Dreamcast has really opened up the minds of you know, so many Solomon Islanders with the creativity and the work that you continue to do. But you know, earlier this week, you and your team were able to have a conversation with the Prime Minister Matthew Wale. I wonder what came out from that discussion, Neil.
It was the first time we were very privileged to have been sitting next to the Prime Minister. It's the first time Dreamcast ever been recognized and being invited or accepted to sit on the table with PM. We basically discussed the journeys and then options for the current challenges that we are facing, particularly the one with the acquisition of the land or purchase of the land. PM has really, let me say, the Prime Minister knows about the place. He knows that this has always been a theatre space and it's always meant for art. So he's familiar with the space and he knows about the work of Dreamcast as well. But, you know, having the young people share, we had four representatives from Dreamcast share the work in front of him, and basically, yeah, he's a cool dude. I like Matthew Wale. He's got really good Bamise ethos in which, and I think he loves the idea of, you know, contemporary art, and he's seen a lot of different performances, but yeah, not much Bamise that him comparing with him Dreamcast. Yeah? So in terms of action, he's committed to work with relevant ministries within the government, so Ministry of Young, Youth, Women, Children and Family Affairs, Ministry of Culture and Tourism, and I think other relevant ministries that has alignment with what's currently going on with Dreamcast. And then I think some of our commitment, Blem, too, is, you know, Prime Minister is willing to, he basically said, leave this to me, I will make sure that we have some remedy. I will do my best to get these ministries and other relevant partners to support where the need is, kind of thing.
Yeah, well, that's really positive from the Prime Minister. I understand you've also been doing a little bit of fundraisers here and there, GoFundMe page. But I also wanted to ask, you're talking about how much are you talking about in terms of saving Dreamcast? How much are you looking at?
Well, Dreamcast has already invested, or let me say, thrown in its own savings from the past years. So it's totaling up to over 600,000 already. And then its total land purchase is 2.2 million. For youth organizations such as ours, you know, we stepped in to sign the agreement because that was the only option that we had. It was supposed to be rented to us for about 40,000 per month. And then we could not afford that. So we took the risk, and beautiful risk, because it's the only time that a youth and possibly citizens can truly own its own, let me say, space globally, and, you know, even closer to us in the region as well. These spaces are diminishing because they're slowly losing their value and then slowly taken away because of other interests, sometimes commercial interests. Growth can be defined differently. But when you lose this kind of spaces, you lose a lot of different things that it would be really hard to find again in the future. And I can tell you, it's our language, it's our dances, it's our songs, it's our sometimes intangible materials that often comes out from these spaces. So 2.2.
And if my maths is mathing this morning, it'll leave you around 1.6 million that is still to be paid. But look, Neil, so much great work coming out from the Dreamcast Hub, and I hope that you and your team will be able to get through this challenge. And I hope that someday too that, you know, you might be able to give golf lessons as well from Dreamcast.
Definitely, man.
Look, thank you so much for time, Blee. You really appreciate it.
Solid. Thank you. Thank you, Krishnita.
Thank you, Tomas. That was Creative Director for Dreamcast Theatre, Neil Nuia, speaking to me there about the future of the Hub after 2 years.
Pacific Beat.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Chris and Rita Omanu-Leong. Well, here's a quick recap of what's been on the show so far. A major crackdown on international scam centers in Timor-Leste sees 350 arrests. Tonga's government has launched a new policy to help deportees reintegrate. We also spoke earlier to Neil Nuia, the co-founder of Dreamcast Theatre, about efforts to save the youth initiative from closure. And later on, we'll also be speaking to a British researcher who says a severe drought was a driving force behind Polynesian migration across the Pacific. But right now, it's time for your news wrap. That's right. It's that time of the day where we take a look at what's making headlines across our region. Today here in studio, sitting across me, is Solomon Islands Broadcasting Corporation's producer and reporter, Alfred Pagepitu. Uriama Vikale, good fella morning. Alfred, how are you?
Hey, good fella morning. Uriama Vikale. Good, and it's a beautiful day today for me.
Yes, it's also great to have you here in studio. We begin here, of course, in Solomon Islands. We've had reports from news media organizations locally. We saw one by In-Depth, also reporting that the police have so far not made any arrests after a series of violent incidents in the Belaha area in central Guadalcanal in the recent days. Alfred, what more do we know about this?
Thank you for this issue. Regarding SIBC, have covered reports that surface in relation to the third-degree incidents at the Belhai in central Guadalcanal constituency, which raise a concern and need for urgent action. So we covered stories in that line. And also, independent leader and their member of parliament, Peter Shannon Angovaka, spoke publicly about the issue and called for an urgent action to stop such activity. So at the same time, the leader of the opposition, Manasseh Songavare, also supported the call, saying it deserves immediate attention from the government. So the Guadalcanal Provincial Government, through the Premier Willie Atu, also joined the two leaders in condemning such act and called for an immediate investigation, and that those involved must face justice. So villages are reporting an increase in home invasions and assaults, including burning of a dump truck and allegations that outsiders, non-Guadalcanal people are doing this. So, yeah, police also issued several press to SIBC, and in response, the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force has begun investigating the issue following the burning of a dump truck at Belaha and RSAPF, and also even other community elders still appeal to members of the public residing in and around the Belaha area who may have informations that could assist the investigation to come forward.
Yes, that's right. I mean, it has received a lot of attention. So many people have been talking about it here in Honiara this week, and we leave it to the responsible authorities to continue with the work, and we ask the public as well to help them out. But Alfred, still here in Solomon Islands, there's a lot of important visits happening. We understand the Prime Minister will travel to United States later in the week, weekend, and then to Japan. But today, Prime Minister Matthew Wale will receive PNG's Prime Minister James Marape. What will form part of the discussions, as we've seen from the reports by the press secretary?
Great. The visit by Prime Minister Marape to the country is more than just a religious visit for Solomon Islands. And Solomon Islands and PNG have a long relationship history, and additionally what we call a Melanesian brother and a Pacific neighbor. So the press yesterday, SIBC have also aired the visit from Prime Minister Marape here in Solomon Islands. And as I know that the Prime Minister's office and the two Prime Ministers will also hold a bilateral talk focusing on strengthening cooperation and advancing shared priority between Solomon Islands and PNG. So while Marape's visit is for the Solomon Islands for Christ program, the two leaders could also discussing existing bilateral agreement on development and economic cooperation, trade, including investment and security and maritime cooperation. So as always, whatever areas that the leaders discuss during their bilateral talks are for the benefit of the two countries.
Yes, absolutely. And finally, you know, the country has been experiencing ongoing recovery efforts after Tropical Cyclone Myla. Alfred, you were able to go down to your village in the western part, or western province rather, where you saw firsthand the devastation that was caused by this tropical cyclone. You've covered this a lot too, working for SIBC. What are people there saying about this, and are they satisfied with the relief efforts they've been receiving so far?
Oh, well, that's a good question to ask. And since the cyclone strike, I was there in the Western Province. And since after the cyclone, communities are now started to, you know, trying to recover their livelihoods. And it's an ongoing recovery efforts in Western Province and include Jezol, in response to the impact of tropical cyclone. So it's good to see that the government, including development partners, have been supporting the relief and recovery effort for these badly affected by the cyclone. And I believe that the government proposal to waive school fee for affected students is a welcoming development. And SIBC is covering more stories from local communities. We hear their complaints, and also we report donors come in and support communities, most affected communities. And let's hope that these affected are beginning to recover, though the assistance provided following the devastating impact of the cyclone. And also NDMO have come out and announced that more than 700 houses destroyed as government prepares to recover plants, and recovery assessment have already completed for worst-hitted provinces, especially Western and Central Province, and health education.
Yes, and no doubt, Alfred, you will be across this with your other colleagues from SIBC. But look, thank you, Tomas, for time, Bliu, and thank you for bringing us all the latest, especially here in Solomon Islands.
Thank you, Tomas.
That was Alfred Pagepitu, Solomon Islands Broadcasting Corporation's reporter and producer, joining me there in studio.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. A study that's published by the University of Southampton in England says that a severe drought that may have been the driving force behind Polynesian migrations into far-flung islands of the eastern Pacific Ocean. According to the study, a prolonged drought in Western Polynesia was the driest in 2,000 years, prompting a wave of voyages towards Hawaii, Rapa Nui, and New Zealand. And on the line with us from the United Kingdom to talk about this fascinating study is one of the authors, Professor David Sia. With that, I say good morning from Solomon Islands, Professor Sia.
And good evening from England, Chrissy.
That's right. Look, just to start things off, I'm really sorry about England's premature exit from the World Cup. How's everyone coping over there?
Very quiet at the moment, I would say. Very quiet day today. It's a sense of inevitability these days. I was born the year before they won the World Cup in 1966, so I've waited literally a lifetime. It's got to continue for another 4 years.
Yes, 4 more years. I mean, look, they're also going to play for the third place, so you still have one more game at least in this FIFA World Cup to watch. But could you tell us about this ancient drought? How severe was it? And take us back in time, you know, when did it take place?
Right, yeah. Thanks for having me on, by the way. It's great to be to be talking about it to the people who actually matters to, perhaps a bit more. So the Great Migrations into the Pacific, they happened around about 3,000 years before now. But the one I've been researching with colleagues at the University of East Anglia happened about 1,000 years ago. So the great voyages had got from sort of Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, through Fiji to Samoa and Tonga, and they got there about 3,000 years ago, and then they didn't really go much further east, or we haven't found any evidence to suggest they did, and they had this long pause in eastward migration into the rest of the Pacific, which lasted about 1,700 years, and so the question has been, why the long pause? And that's That's kind of the basis of a lot of research, and many people have thought, well, could it be that their canoe technology, the voyaging canoes, the vakas, were just not up to the job, or could it have been they didn't need to? The islands were big enough to support their population. All kinds of ideas, and one of the ones that we worked on was this idea of perhaps climate being a forcing factor.
Yes, and as well as that, I mean, one of the things that came out from the study is also how there's also change in technology and how the hulls of canoes had changed from being U-shaped to V-shaped. I mean, could you tell us a little bit more about this?
I can, but the real experts there are Jeff Irwin and Richard Flay and others in the University of Auckland who did the work. But, so the ability to sail east into the Pacific from Samoa and Tonga requires you to just kind of head into the wind. So if you have a V-shaped hull and different sail technology, that's all going to help you to be able to sail closer into that wind. And so instead of it being a barrier, you can actually voyage into the wind and therefore head east into the Pacific. So that was one of the theories. Unfortunately, we don't have any evidence, physical evidence, that is, of these canoes from that time. Just afterwards, in the period when they were sailing into the East Pacific, we've started to get physical evidence, but not for that period before. So we can't answer it directly. But of course, the other factor is this climate factor. And we were able to go and collect mud samples from the bottoms of lakes and swamps. And they tell a record of past climate. And so that's what we did. And we found consistently in Samoa and recently in Tonga, up in Uvea in Vanuatu, we found evidence for this really quite a pronounced dry period just before and during that period when they migrated east. So, you know, it's interesting that it occurs at the same time. And when we did the some modelling work as well, using some climate models to answer the question, well, could it have been possible and what conditions would have made it possible? It looks it looks like it can be made possible by changes in the ocean temperature and the ocean temperature gradients between west and east, which drive convection, which gives you the rainfall across the islands. So we're pretty excited. It's good evidence.
Yes, and I suppose that the study also reveals quite a lot. Climate drives migration, discovery, and the birth of different cultures and societies. And as you say earlier, it is very much for the Pacific people and the Pacific audiences who are listening in. But look, that's all we have time for. And I'd say thank you too much. Thank you, Tomas, for your insights on this as well, Professor.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you for having me on.
Thank you. That was Professor David Sear. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Kristen Rita Aumanu-Leong, and it's time for sport, where the rise of the Flying Fijians to Tier 1 status is unravelling rapidly over in the UK after a disappointing loss to Wales that was followed by a demoralising hammering at the hands of England. Next up in the Rugby Nations Championship this weekend, Fiji will take on Scotland, and most observers fear the worst. So, what's gone wrong? Well, Richard Ayward has been talking to Isaiah Washington, the moderator of the Fiji Rugby Landscape social media group, which has nearly 87,000 followers.
I personally feel that Fiji Rugby may have got this one wrong, the first big dance at this level, and we've gone and appointed a local coach. We are all aware of his limitations. I think Fiji Rugby should have given him more specialist coaches to help him with this mammoth task. The body language of the players, it suggests a fractured camp. And I've managed to interview a couple of players in confidence. And yes, it is a fractured camp. It's quite sad. We should have never been placed in a situation like this. You have a head coach. His style of coaching is very different. You have World Cup players. You have Olympians. You have top 14 winners. And the word coming back is it's been run like a kindergarten. If you look at how we lost to Wales, where we were at against England, it's going to be a mammoth task even to put on a strong showing against Scotland this weekend, given what's transpiring in camp.
There was the speculation earlier in the week that Prime Minister Rambuka had intervened personally and ordered the dismissal of Mick Byrne and the employment of Seni Saravakura as a local coach. Now, he's since denied that, but he did come out and say he was in support of a local coach because they would understand Fijian culture and Fijian ways. But I don't know how relevant that is when you're dealing with players, most of whom are based in Europe. They're living a different life. They're not living in Fiji anymore. Obviously, they have their roots, but they're living a very different life as a professional player.
100%. From Vern Cotter through to Simon Rowley to Mick Bynes, they all learnt to understand Fijian culture and to bring the best out of them, to have a structured game and use the Fijian flair. And then all of a sudden, you've gone to a coach that is supposed to understand Fijian culture. But at the moment, it seems to be the very point of the breakdown in camp.
So let's assume that they lose the game against Scotland. And at the moment, that would seem highly likely. That will be three home losses in a row, because these are, after all, meant to be home games, but they're being played in the UK because Fiji doesn't have a stadium that meets the requirements of world rugby. And in theory, they can make a lot of money in England, Scotland and Wales. There were 50,000 people last week turned up to watch Fiji play. So I suppose if nothing else comes out of this, there should be some money, shouldn't there?
Yes, I think the FRE got that part of the campaign right. If projections forecast, you know, they should be coming with at least converted Fiji dollars about 10 million, which is what they wanted to help start off this new stadium that we, you know, were much needed. But then again, we have to ask at what expense? Marketing is only as good as the product that you sell. And if we are going to get some humiliating results, how's that going to play out in November when we go up against France, Ireland and Italy? You know, will people turn up to watch that based on our performances in July?
Would you be at all surprised if a different coach was in charge for the three matches to be played in November? And probably, I would suggest, not a local coach, therefore.
My understanding is Seni Rusi was given a KPI of 2 wins. If that was the case, then he hasn't met his KPI. I think we would need an overseas-based coach, given that the majority of the Flying Fijians come out of Europe playing in highly professional environments, and someone with that sort of knowledge and working at that level is probably the best to move us forward. But having said that, if the notion is that we do want a local coach, and Seni Rusi is the best local coach we have available, we need to attach him to our coaching staff moving forward. Because at some stage, if we want to hand over the reins to him permanently, amongst other things, he's got to learn to sharpen his people management skills.
Right now for Fiji Rugby and for Fiji Rugby followers, clearly the Flying Fijians is the big negative. But there is a positive. Fijiana and Drua have a home semi-final in the Super Rugby Women's competition this weekend, and there'll be two test matches played in Fiji for the national women's team against South Africa later in the year. So it seems to me the women's game is pretty much on track.
It is on the rise, and it's great to see with the fan base. It's not just women that are turning up. It's men, grown men, the older generation. Everybody's jumping on the Fijian Drua and the Fijiano bandwagon. It's great for the sport. And I'm pretty sure the walk-up audience this Saturday to Churchill Park in Lautoka is going to be awesome. And should they beat Queensland, it'll be a historic first Super W final in Fiji, which I'm guessing is going to be in Bar. So that's massive for women's rugby.
It also, I would suggest, makes something of a statement when we reflect on the Flying Fijians being forced to play home games on the other side of the world. Maybe playing in front of a smaller crowd in Fiji is the way to go. Rather than looking at how much money we can make, let's look at what's best for the team.
Maybe it's something that, you know, World Rugby and Fiji Rugby can negotiate now, you know, having seen what's transpired in the last two games and likely this weekend. So, yeah, we'll definitely love to see rugby played back home. You know, you still get 15,000 crazy fans and it'll be a totally different game from being played in Europe.
I note a comment regarding the upcoming test matches for the women against South Africa. There you go. They will travel to the Pacific to play us down here, the Tier 1 nations. But that's at the root of the problem, isn't it? That these countries over there, England, Scotland, Ireland, France, they don't want to make the trip. Australia and New Zealand don't want to make the trip.
That is correct. Fiji have the Vuvale partnership with Australia. When was the last time Australia come to play in Fiji? Can we get World Rugby engaged so that come 2028, if we don't have the stadium ready, can we still bring our home games home for the diehard fans to watch?
That was Isaiah Washington, moderator of the Fiji Rugby Landscape. And that, of course, brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at our main story today. A major crackdown on international scam centers in Timor-Leste has resulted in 350 arrests. Well, stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because up next is news, and coming up after that is Nisha Daily. I'm Kristen Rita Omanu-Leong. Have a good day.